Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program today, South Africa's investment pipeline has taken a 580 billion rand knock, raising fresh questions about growth, jobs and government finances. The National Union of Mine Workers is taking on President Ramaphosa over Eskom's restructuring plans. South Africa's unemployment crisis is worsening again, with joblessness back at a four-year high. And the Zondo and Matlanga commissions raise uncomfortable questions. How much institutional failure starts with hiring the wrong people? It's Thursday, the 13th of August. South Africa has suffered a dramatic setback in planned investment, with the value of new projects announced in the first half of this year falling 81% to an annualized 137.7 billion rand. Now, to give you some context, that's around 580 billion rand below last year and the weakest level since 2017, if I've read the numbers correctly. Obviously, this raises uncomfortable questions about business confidence, about future growth, jobs, and ultimately government revenue. Let's put all of that into some perspective. I'm in conversation now with Isaiah Mhlanga, who is chief economist at RMB. Isaiah, a very warm welcome to you. Is this an investment collapse, or are we in danger of making too much of one particularly weak six-month period?
Look, it is a concerning development. When we started the year, we were expecting quite a robust investment growth. And then we had the shock from the Middle East conflict, and that compounded, the tariff wars that Donald Trump and his administration started. So it's a conflation of many factors, partly global. That means the supply chains we've been talking about, triggered by the trade tariffs, are actually having an impact. If you are not so sure how your products are going to get into the US or, into another market, you are not going to expand production capacity until you are quite sure. So that had an impact. And from a domestic perspective, the shock from fuel price is quite real. It's a tax on consumption, which means companies that are facing the consumer are also going to be quite hesitant to expand production over the short term. But over the medium to longer term, there are also concerns about economic policy. It's an uncertain political cycle that we are going into, and the Operation Vulindlela are still ongoing. Some successes on phase one, phase two experiences some difficulties as per National Treasury. There's update that 80% of what was announced in phase two is either derailed or running behind schedule. And then we can talk about beyond 2027, what happens into 2029. There is changes in political leadership in the largest party so far, which means it's uncertain what comes after that. Does it, keep the GNU and the Operation Vulindlela policies intact? If you don't know all of those questions, it means you are likely to withhold investing in production capacity until we have a little bit more clarity.
And that clarity is going to be hard to find. And what it is suggesting is that government itself is failing to invest at the scale that it keeps promising. Isaiah, the president keeps talking about an unprecedented infrastructure drive, but it's patently obvious those ambitions are not yet showing up more strongly in this vitally urgent project pipeline.
No, they are not showing up strongly as expected. In the project pipeline that you're talking about, that's where the problem lies. The investment drive is underpinned by investment by the private sector and not necessarily by the public sector. Yes, the public sector has a role to play, but the majority of it has to be privately funded. That's where the issue of confidence lies. And I guess that's where we need to hear a lot more from government in terms of, the stability of the policy proposals. Perhaps they're not communicating as much to say, even in the event that there are different outcomes politically, from a government policy perspective, the reforms that are taking place now, they are crystallized in how we look at investment going forward, so that it can ease the uncertainty from an investor perspective to look through the political cycle that we have now.
And what do you think prevents government from making that kind of commitment?
Potentially, it's because there are still differences on policy positions. And we see this, starkly in what's happening in the energy space in ESCOM and the presidency. There seem to be different views as far as, what structure the different, entities that are going to come out of ESCOM is going to look like. And that introduces uncertainty to funding partners to say, if we are not so sure, if we're seeing disagreements between a government-owned entity and, the president's or government, then it means we are far worse in terms of understanding what's going on. So we stay on the sidelines.
Talking about staying on the sidelines, private sector projects then account for just over 107 billion rand of that total that I mentioned. The reality, I think I'm hearing you say, is that companies will continue sitting on that cash because they don't believe growth is going to materialize. What are they going to do with that money?
Look, if you think about long-term investors, now they can invest offshore up to 45%. That is your pension fund industries that have a lot of capital, which means they're going to look offshore. And if they are in the domestic market, you have to assess the risks. And if the risk seems too high, given what we've been talking about now from a policy perspective, you can just put money in a government bond. That's like the least risk investment that you're almost guaranteed to get your money back. And that we see in the market, where the allocation to bonds have been quite strong over the last couple of years, it hasn't changed as much, which means public sector has been crowding out private sector investment, sucking all the capital into funding government. And yet the actual output that we get from government spending, the quality has been quite poor. There is a change. We have to recognize that. Rating agencies have also recognized that. A lot have been done so far. If you look at the balance sheet of SA Inc. have repaired, which is what rating agencies have responded by upgrading and changing ratings to positive outlooks. But we are not yet seeing that translate into better confidence. That's what we need to see going forward.
And if we're not seeing that confidence, this weak investment is already starting, I imagine, to feed into weaker tax revenue. And that obviously puts greater pressure on government finances, and it becomes a vicious circle.
Indeed, if growth remains weak, with a growing population growing at a 1.5% per year, growth at less than 1%, it means in per capita terms we are going backwards. The biggest detractor have to do with local government dynamics. That's where every person lives. That's where every business operates. It operates in a municipality somewhere, which means if we are not solving the permitting, the licensing, the water, bulk water infrastructure, the electricity distribution, all of those things, the impact on business confidence and investment. Unfortunately, they are not, the businesses that operate at a locality, they don't get, the positive impact that are coming out of the big reforms that are at a national level. These are small micro enterprises, medium enterprises that do not necessarily benefit from the large infrastructure development pipeline, which means they are facing the dysfunction of municipalities and not feeling the positive impact of the reform momentum.
Isaiah Mplanga is the chief economist at Rand Merchant Bank.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
A major fight is brewing over the future of Eskom. Government wants to establish a fully independent state-owned transmission system operator. It argues that it's going to unlock investment, it'll increase competition and ultimately help deliver more reliable and affordable electricity. But the National Union of Mine Workers says the restructuring risk is becoming privatization by stealth and is preparing both court action and possible worker mobilization. Eskom's energy sector coordinator is Kangela Baloyi and joins me on the program now. Kangela, welcome to you. What exactly then do you believe is unlawful or unconstitutional about this proposed restructuring?
Yeah, it is the constitutional mandate of the state to provide electricity for both poor and rich people. But when you privatize electricity, the result will be that the price of electricity will be so high that the poor people won't be able to afford electricity. When you unbundle Eskom, you are preparing it for privatization. It is a neoliberal project that is run by the state to actually privatize the state companies.
Government, though, is insisting the new transmission operator will remain state-owned. Why are you calling it privatization then?
You see, sometimes we don't believe everything that the state is saying. For long, they were saying, no, they're just separating these companies into three. All of a sudden, now the NTCSA, which was separated 2 years back, is going to be taken out of Eskom completely. That was not the initial agreement. So how do we trust that they're not going to, after separating the assets, privatize the TSO?
Is it not risky going to court and possibly even striking to stop a reform that government claims is essential to fixing South Africa's electricity system?
No, it might be risky. You know, even fighting apartheid was risky. You know, when there is unjust system or unjust reforms that are implemented by the state, society must stand up and fight against that injustice.
Is your objection not necessarily ownership, but rather the creation of a competitive electricity market in which Eskom is no longer the dominant player and in which you are a significant stakeholder as organized labor?
No. The problem is there's a belief that anything that is private work, and it is not necessarily true. Sometimes it does not work. You know, I can give you example of a lot of reforms that were implemented in this country, like the issue of hospitals and schools. You know, they are becoming too expensive that poor people don't afford it. You can see now we have a lot of private universities for only rich people. And the state is no longer building private public universities, same as hospitals. So this neoliberal project is going to leave poor people with no services.
If government gave you an enforceable guarantee that workers would not lose their jobs or their current conditions of employment, would NUM support the restructuring?
No, we don't support the restructuring. We have been clear that we don't support the restructuring from the start. We said we are against unbundling. We are not against any innovative idea to make sure that Eskom becomes more profitable and productive. We don't oppose that. But we oppose reforms that are going to create a situation where Eskom itself dies. Because if you look at it, they started with independent power producers that were eating the market of Eskom, you know, competing with Eskom generations. Now is this TSO. They will come with independent transmission providers and also distribution providers. And then after that, you will see no existence of Eskom. So and then after you have killed Eskom, now electricity prices can jump up and then no poor people are not going to be able to afford that.
So what do you say to government's argument that an independent transmission operator is necessary because the grid operator shouldn't favour Eskom over competing generators? What is fundamentally wrong with that principle? Because it does guarantee, surely, a better supply, a more consistent supply of electricity.
Yeah, you see, our take is electricity is a private, it's a public good. It's a public good that must not be privatized. We want electricity generation, transmission, and distribution to remain in the hands of the state, so that the state can be able to provide this service to all people, regardless of whether you have money or not.
But Kangela, back to my original point, government keeps insisting the new transmission operator will remain state-owned. They are saying it's not privatization.
But where did they get this from? You know, because this project, our understanding is a project of the World Bank. It has been implemented in other countries and it failed. It failed in Nigeria. Nigeria is forever now in load shedding. It failed in Ghana. It failed in Tanzania. It failed in Germany. Spain had power outages early this year because of the same liberalization of the energy sector project.
Your argument is that liberalization threatens jobs and working conditions. I'm sure that you have crunched the numbers, you've done the modeling. How many jobs then do you believe are actually at risk if this process goes forward?
We might not be having exact numbers, but we have learned a lesson from Komati Power Station. When this liberalization project closed the Komati Power Station, a lot of people lost their jobs. Komati as a town now is a ghost town. And if this project continue and we end up closing some of the power stations, we can actually estimate how many people are going to be affected. Those who are working in power stations and also those who are working in coal mines and other value chain jobs.
So what then is your alternative? And this is a last question to you. If you're rejecting an independent transmission operator and greater competition, is there a model that you are proposing that would deliver cheaper electricity, more grid investment, and something that affects all of us, better energy security?
No, we are saying the vertical integrated structure was working. It worked for 100 years. There's nothing that is broken. We don't understand why the state wants to fix something that is not broken. We understand that Eskom has got challenges, and those challenges cannot be fixed by the proposed reform. This proposed reform cannot bring the price of primary energy down. It cannot make sure that there is increased sales of Eskom. It cannot even assist in payments of the IPPs, because those are the problems of Eskom. Eskom is paying IPPs a lot of money. The sales are going down, and also the cost of primary energy.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Kangela Baloyi, who is the National Union of Mine Workers Energy Sector Coordinator.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's unemployment crisis has taken another turn for the worse. The official unemployment rate climbing to a four-year high, 33.6% in the second quarter, with another 345,000 people joining the ranks of the unemployed, youth unemployment, and this is the scary number, rising to 47.4%. I think the question is whether this is another weak quarter or evidence that South Africa's economy is now becoming structurally incapable of creating enough jobs. It's an important issue, and I want to discuss it with Labour analyst Mamogeti Molopiani. Mamogeti, a very warm welcome to you. 34% unemployment. What's fundamentally broken in the labour market?
What is fundamentally broken, Jeremy, is that often government have put plans, the plans that they implement are trying to put in place to say they are going to tackle unemployment, and at the same time trying to address the economy, have not worked. They have reached a crisis level, and it seems like there is no clear cut out a solution that's coming from government as to how are we going to tackle unemployment. Instead, we are seeing a very neoliberal approach to government policies. We are seeing a government that often at times implement austerity measures and try to contain the challenges that they're facing in the economy rather than address them directly. And that is why we are here. As you have said in the opening, we are at a four-year high in the second quarter. And this is a serious crisis. We are no longer using the language of government of saying this is a challenge. It is a serious crisis. If you look at the fact that we have now, I think quarter-on-quarter comparison, we are now at 8.2 million people that are unemployed. And also we are seeing that the youth unemployment, as you have highlighted, it's at a far higher level than the national unemployment rate. And that, for me, paints a picture of a government that cannot tackle issues that are facing its youth, but also that we have a number of young people working age group that have never known work and will never know work and do not have access to job opportunities. And that is a crisis for a dominant population in a country.
Let me push a little further on youth unemployment. 47.5%, 5 million young people now unemployed. As you rightly say, many of those will not know what work is or is likely to be. At what point do you think this simply becomes beyond an economic crisis, but actually a social stability risk?
It has. It's
Are
not
we there
at
already?
That point, but yes, it has long become a socio-economic crisis. But from the time where youth unemployment far exceeded the normal accepted international standards, when it hovered around 28 and it reached 30, that is a crisis. And so different government that were in administration since democracy have failed to prioritize youth employment. We've heard them talk about different plans for work. I mean, I think in 2010, there was a theme called the year of the job, and nothing materialized out of that. And shortly afterwards, the programs that came. And I'm going to use two provinces, Jeremy, as example. From the data that came out from Stats SA a day or so ago, Northwest and the Eastern Cape have an unemployment rate of above 53%, both of them. So I think Northwest is at 56 and the Eastern Cape is at 54% across all races. That's a crisis. And if you include it, when you look at that, these are the provinces that are also impacted in terms of the number of young people, young African people, who also mostly happens to be female, who are not employed. So it has reached, it has long passed a crisis. Youth unemployment has long passed the crisis level. And it's devastating because the truth that will not be sugar-coated, Jeremy, is that the government does not care. Or when it pretends to care, it does not have a plan in place as to how are we going to tackle this. And we are seeing in the number of plans that they have, they are focusing on, at the moment, special economic zones. When you look at provinces like Northwest and the Northern and the Eastern Cape, where are they going to be located, those special economic zones? You realize that they're going to miss the majority of the young people that they should be targeting.
Right. So you talk about the neoliberal approach not working. So if government wants to reset the process, if they need to make one big intervention capable of materially changing this unemployment trajectory within the next 18 months to 2 years, as difficult as that may sound, what does it need to do first, do you think?
One of the key things that, and it's going to be unpopular, one of the key things that it needs to do is lower the tax rate, the taxes that they are charging and many people are paying. And rather than trying to bail out the and put in the tax incentives to private sector, let the average ordinary South African have more tax basis, have more access and rather reduce tax contribution, rather target the super rich, as it were, and reduce the tax, and so that we can free up some resources and we can free up capital so that the middle that is heavily taxed and that is so little but contributes so much to that tax collection can be able to reuse that money in the economy. And then the other thing, we have talked about this, I think, previously in many of our interviews, Jeremy. The regulation has become so strict, continues to be strict, while claiming to be protecting the very workers that cannot enter the labor market. They need to relax the practices on the labor market in terms of hiring, in terms of who comes, who goes, and allow flexibility, because that has created the bottlenecks in terms for many medium to small companies, because they have to go through such a significant red tape that by the time they have cleared those red tapes, they've spent most of their time focusing on that. They are no longer interested in creating employment. But also at the same time, it's a reality that I think the private sector has to come on board. South Africa's private sector has been rather complacent, even at the time of the Mbeki administration, where things were seen as favoring them the most. They have sat very comfortably where they are and said, we will let government do the heavy lifting. And as such, we are seeing a public sector now that is the biggest employer, when it is unsustainable, when the private sector needs to come on board. And at times the private sector has a point to say, we cannot come on board because your policies often are not clear, but where they are clear, there is a significant red tape and bottlenecks that are constraining us. Case an example, we know of the mining sector, the challenges that have gone in terms of the Empowerment Act, Once Empowered, Always Empowered, MPRD Act, how that lengthy process of that regulation of that legislature has, in a way, kind of like prevented attracting investment into the sector, because they have said, up until you, South Africa, sort your mining regulation and sort your position clearly as government, where you stand, we will hold our investment.
Whichever way you look at it, it is a very disturbing number. Those figures now at a four-year high. Mamogeti Molopoyane, thank you very much indeed. Labour analyst, appreciate your time. The headlines tell you what's happening, but do you know what it means for your money? Join MoneyWeb editor Rek van Niekerk in conversation with National Treasury Director General Dr. Duncan Pieterse and Gina Skuman, head of Citi Research South Africa, as they explain the economic forces shaping South Africa's future and your financial future. Tuesday, the 1st of September at the Sandton Convention Centre. Register for free using the promo code MoneyWeb. MoneyWeb Summit in partnership with MoneyWeb, the conversations that move markets and your money.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's commissions of inquiry have exposed corruption, political interference and institutional failure. But governance specialist Sizwe Qai from SGA Law argues that many of those failures begin much earlier, with the people organizations choose to appoint and the warning signs they ignore afterwards. He argues that compromised appointments, weak oversight and poor people management helped create the conditions in which corruption could flourish in the first place. Sizwe, a very warm welcome to you. I just want to test the thesis of your argument then. Are you suggesting that some of South Africa's biggest governance failures, not beginning with corruption, but simply putting the wrong people in the wrong place? It's an interesting argument, but some might say it's a stretch.
I suppose everything is interconnected, right? When you look at it holistically, to say, before an organization fails, where does it begin? What we as a public get exposed to is what is the end result? A big scandal, you know, in procurement, financial mismanagement, and the like. But let's go to where it all begins. Take a public entity like a Transnet or an SAA. It is first established by an Act of Parliament, and it sets out what are the objectives of this entity, what must it do. And we're now to assess whether or not that entity will be successful. You have to check whether or not the people that are in charge of that institution are the right people. It applies when you establish the entity, and it also applies on an ongoing basis. It's not good enough to have the right people in the beginning, but the entity must continue to have the right people on an ongoing basis to ensure its survival.
So if that's true, then how do obviously unsuitable people get through what should be a rigorous appointment process?
I mean, if we think about it, let's go back to the founding of modern South Africa. I'll take it from a constitutional point of view. It's something that even us as lawyers don't normally pay attention to. You know, the drafters of our constitution were quite visionary. There's a clause, Section 195 in the Constitution, which we don't pay attention to. But basically, Section 195 gives a clear mandate that public administration ought to be governed by democratic values and principles. And that includes setting high standards of professional ethics, efficient use of economic resources, and adopting employment practices that are based on ability, objectivity, fairness, and the need to redress the imbalances of the past. But if you look at it, even at the architect of our constitution, There ought to be no excuse for anyone occupying a public role in South Africa who does not meet the standards stipulated in the Constitution to be part of, to be placed right in a critical position in government. So there's a constitutional violation to start off with by having a wrong character at SAA, Transnet, and the like. So if you think about it now, to say what I think has happened in South Africa, which we now, fortunately, we have an opportunity to rebuild the country and correct the wrong things that have happened. Because one of the things that we've done with our colleagues was to assess, we've had these two big commissions of inquiry. I'll call in my analysis the Zondo Commission of Inquiry and the ongoing Matlanga Commission of Inquiry the most consequential commissions of inquiry in South Africa,
right,
due to the nature of the issues that they are looking into. Not that the others were not important, but I think there's never been a commission of inquiry that, shocks the very existence of the state as we know it.
So is the real failure then, I'm just trying to get my head around your argument, is the real failure HR governance at the beginning and during the tenure of a person's employment, or is it simply political and executive interference that I sense just overrides any kind of HR practice?
I will say ultimately, if we have to pinpoint it, it is an HR governance failure. And we have to expand this proposition, because it's not simple to say there's an HR governance failure, because ultimately what you have in institutions is the HR function is usually a subordinate function. Say to your, HR executives do not sit in the board. They report to the CEO sometimes, and sometimes they are even relegated to report to the COO. So they don't have a lot of powers from an accounting point of view in terms of are they the ultimate accounting authorities. So you find out that they are reduced. But be that as it may, let's forget about who occupies the role and where they are. The governance of HR as a discipline is something that ought to take center stage, in the deliberations of the board, and say, is the HR governance function properly protected in our organization? So let's go back to the hiring processes. If you look at people who've landed in critical state institutions, you will doubt whether, proper vetting is done. It's clearly proper, there are instances where there is no basic vetting done. If you have someone, for example, landing in PRASA, who does not have an engineering degree, but they are the head of engineering, and it turns out they never even had a matric certificate,
yes,
to start with. So clearly there was a complete failure of vetting there. It goes to people who will even say this outright corruption, but someone had to tick that box and say, in the beginning, this person has a degree, which they didn't have in the beginning. So there was no vetting.
But
there was not,
It's a good argument, but what happens when the problem is at the very top, at the apex of an organization? Who vets the board, the chairperson, or the political office bearer who is making the appointment in the first place? Surely that's the conundrum.
And I think now something coming out of in the beginning, so we have this problem that, we elect politicians who have these appointing powers. But if a politician presiding over an entity oversees a process that in the end leads to people who are not qualified being in the right position, let's say now even the very board appointments themselves, you have a problem there, which then leads technically that politician has breached the constitution, and there ought to be consequences on that. If you look at the Zondo Commission of Inquiry now in terms of the recommendations, part of what is recommended there is that the appointments of boards into public entities must be removed from politicians, because it's exactly to protect so that we can have a transparent process, understand who gets appointed, and the process that is followed to get those people appointed.
Right.
So if that recommendation can be properly implemented, we will find at least South Africa can be protected from these irregular appointments that have been done in the past. Because normally, if you take an entity that has been in existence for quite a number of years, which ought to be at a continuity stage, succession planning is something that ought to be done properly in a board. It must not go with a political tenure. It's all about ensuring that, you know, the existing board, when its term of office comes to an end, and also how you normally plan for succession planning in a board, you don't want a situation right. where everyone is stepping down at the same time. You will typically want, let's say, an ideal scenario would be to have a group coming in, but there must be a balance of the people who are coming in and those who are retiring. Right. But public institutions have not enjoyed that because politicians have considered this, that, you know, it is their right to chop a change boards when they come into office, which is inconsistent with the constitution. Right.
Well, certainly a lot to chew on there. Thanks to Sizwe Tsai from SGA Law Africa. I do appreciate your time. Thank you. And on that note, we will say goodbye. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.